Good morning. My name is Mark Clark, and along with Larry Weaver and Michaela Sievers, we're going to be bringing you a fascinating presentation today. So, welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Fellowship of Manhattan. We are a relatively small fellowship, but we're growing bigger. We welcome everyone to join us, regardless of age, color, sexual identity, and orientation. We like big thinkers and those that concern themselves with the tiniest details. We are a diverse group of people with many beliefs and backgrounds, people with a religious background, people with none, people who believe in God, people who don't, and people who just let the mystery be. We are Unitarian Universalists, and we are Buddhist, Christian, Hindu, humanist, Jewish, Muslim, pagan, atheist, agnostic, and more. And whether you're as small as the baby that just came in, or as large as probably Gene Sievers, you're welcome here. If you are a visitor, welcome. And if you wouldn't mind, we ask you that you sign the guest book out in the narthex when you get a chance. We welcome you to explore our universe with us today. We'll be exploring the tiniest of the tiny and the largest of the large. We'll explore not only the physical nature of these objects, but include some historical or cultural aspects of the subject. We hope to educate, inspire, entertain, and challenge you. I didn't get any additional announcements, so there's probably some in the program for today, which I haven't looked at, sorry. But I do have a pretty large announcement, and you're all looking at it. If you look up, you'll notice that there's new lights for the first time since this sanctuary was built. And a small army of people contributed time and sweat. I don't know about tears. I didn't see any of those. And I'd like to recognize Doug Walter, who's not here today. He's floating on the river on purpose. He's on a kayak. Mark Mayfield, Dave Lambert, Brent Garrison. I don't know if everybody knows who he is, but he, it's Amy Fowler's husband. He pulled our fat out of the fire, if you will, came up with a better design that would actually work than the one we had come up with, and he did most of the hard labor, honestly. He's a good guy. So if you see him, tell him thanks very many times. Chris Bailey, Jessica Sievers, Kathleen Oldfather, Michael Oldfather, and Michaela Sievers, and last and certainly not least, Jane Pelletier, who provided us with sugar while we were working, and we appreciate that. And actually, you get to... There are some leftovers, so everybody will get to, you don't have to put up any lights, and you still get to eat them. So again, thanks to all those people, and these lights will be... one final announcement. I'm going to be taking the lift back tomorrow. I could use a body here for maybe 2 hours. Starting at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. If you can, just let me know after the service. It's not going to be too difficult. I just need to get it out of the building and onto a trailer, and then I'll take it back to the rental agency. So, the words for the actually I didn't blow out the chalice after I tested it. So we already did the lighting. Sorry, but I'm going to say the words that I had to go along with the lighting. And these are from the astronomer, cosmologist, astrophysicist, and astrobiologist, and author Carl Sagan. And probably most of you know who that is, one of my personal heroes. The size and age of the cosmos are beyond ordinary human understanding. Lost somewhere between immensity and eternity is our tiny planetary home. In a cosmic perspective, most humans' concerns seem insignificant, even petty. And yet our species is young and curious and brave and shows much promise. In the last few millennia, we have made the most astonishing and unexpected discoveries about the cosmos and our place within it, explorations that are exhilarating to consider. They remind us that humans have evolved to wonder, that understand is a joy, and knowledge is a prerequisite to survival. I believe our future depends on how well we know the cosmos in which we float like a mote of dust in the morning sky. And so our goal this morning is to expand our ordinary human understanding. So our opening hymn today is number 61. If you would rise as you are able and join us, enter, rejoice, and come in. Sorry, 361. And now it's time for joys and sorrows. You are invited to share a significant joy or sorrow in your life. Please wait for the microphone before beginning your remarks.
Hi, Larry Weaver. I have had two wonderful weeks with my children and grandchildren from Germany. 1 week, the German contingent and our youngest son and I went canoeing the Buffalo River in Arkansas, and it was beautiful. The next week, the German contingent and our other sons in Minnesota and Manhattan went out to New Mexico, where we hiked at Ghost Ranch. It was wonderful. After the Germans left and I got home, I've been sleeping a lot.
Just an update from our visitors a couple weeks ago. So some of you were here when the Nelson Mandela, the Mandela Washington Fellows were here. We had three visitors from that group that was in Manhattan for 6 weeks. And the gal and I, Stu, whose African name I cannot pronounce at all, became friends on Facebook, and so I've been watching her journey. So they went to Washington, D.C. She got to meet the president, shake his hand. She got to meet all these other people, and she's in New York City now, traveling around and getting lost and just posting the cutest, most excited things that you'd ever see. And so I appreciate everybody here being so nice and welcoming and sharing something with that group that was here from Africa. Thank you.
I just wanted to mention Martha Slack. Most of you do not know her, but some of us old folks do. She was a member here for many, many years. She's probably the only person that taught more RE than Larry Weaver did. She went on for years and years teaching. She was an inspiration, one of the most creative and joyous people. She died last month living in Oklahoma. Her husband, Rex, is the one who designed the remake of this building way back when we first came here, long before this sanctuary was a thought. And Martha was a delight to be around. And she was a big contribution to this fellowship back when. Oh, I should mention one other thing. In our newsletter, it mentioned that she is survived by her son, Jimmy, but it didn't mention Jean Marie, who had been living with Martha for some time, and I'm assuming she is also a survivor.
So Sam's older sister graduated from college this summer, Kalamazoo, and the reason we haven't been in church the last couple of weeks is that she took her first job in Boston, working for a pretty neat UU appropriate organization.
City Year.
City Year in Boston, which kind of specializes in providing education to underprivileged and inner city youths.
Bryce and Shirley and Kathleen and I went to the Manhattan Arts Center last night to watch the tastefully presented hair. It was a great, in large part, because the piano part was played by Renee, and it was wonderful. And you could take your children. A few places you might have to cover their ears, but otherwise... It wouldn't be anything they hadn't already heard. But it was marvelous. It was just extremely well done.
Oh.
I just want to share a little joy. We have our great friend and my girl's godmother, Kathy Bilinowski, in town with us from Kansas City, so I'm embarrassing her. She's a naturalist and a horticulturalist in Kansas City, and we've been hanging out at the lake and enjoying ourselves, so we're glad she's here today.
Thank you for sharing your joys or sorrows, and please know that all the joys and concerns shared today and those which remain unspoken are kept in our hearts. And now it's time for a story for all ages with our favorite storyteller, Larry. If the young ones want to come up.
Well, the story today really is a story for all ages. It's a story about beginnings. It's a story that in the beginning is a little speculative, but the rest of it is the way we think the world actually works. This is a story for all ages because, and now let me arrange this so that I can look at the folks right here. This is a story about the whole universe and you and me and all of these folks here and the trees outside and the carpet and the air we breathe. All of this, all of us are, as a poet once said, brothers of the boulders and sisters of the stars, because the calcium in your teeth and bones and the iron in your blood, these atoms in you were born when stars exploded and died. The air we breathe, the atoms in the air we breathe, were built as stars lived their lives and were spread out through the universe when those stars died. We really are sisters of the stars, brothers to the boulders. So here's a story about that. It's called The Everything Seed. And it goes like this. Have you ever watched a seed grow? You know, it starts real small, but then it shoots up and up and up until it may be a huge flower. Now that's also true about the very first seed. Once long, long ago, way back before the beginning, so long ago, there was no such thing as time. There was no one there to measure it. Everywhere was a huge, deep, mysterious place, like something waiting to happen. There were no stars. There was no sun or moon. There was no place like Earth, not a drop of water, not a breath of air. There were no living things anywhere. But in that deep waiting space was hidden the tiniest point of something no bigger than a seed. You see that little seed right there? For the grown-ups, that little seed right there, according to some of the admittedly speculative modern theories, is the size that has grown into the observable universe today. Okay, this really is a story for all ages. Now, this was not a flower seed. It was not an oak tree seed, not a seed of corn, although all those things were included in this seed. You might call it an everything seed, because that is what it became. No one knows where that first seed came from, how it was planted, or how it knew in the way that only seeds seem to know
how long to wait for just the right moment to sprout and grow. But all at once, this tiny seed, cradled and nourished in the rich soil of space, woke up, broke open, and began to unfold. Unfolding, unfolding, and blossoming forth into an enormous blazing ball of bright light like a great grandmother sun. And this is what we would today call the Big Bang, right here. And from here on out, things are much less speculative than before. Here, we've done experiments. We have experience that convinces we do understand what's been happening since that time, about 14 billion years ago. The universe was born. Out fluttered the galaxies like a storm of snowflakes swirling, gathering into the brightest, most blindingly beautiful clouds of stars. And out of those star clouds whirled our own star, the one we call the sun, and Earth, and the moon, and all the round spinning planets that we've learned how to name. And this is the secret of that tiny seed. You and I were there in the very beginning. Just as the idea for each leaf on a big oak tree lies hidden inside an acorn, so it was that you were there with all the stars and planets, all your atoms, all the things that make you, all the rocks and oceans, plants and animals and people, everything that is now, that ever was, or ever will be, was inside that first tiny seed. So whenever you hold a seed in your hand and wonder what it could become, imagine, just imagine how you and all that is once came from the tiniest speck of an everything seed before it sprouted and grew long, long ago in the way back beginning of time. Now, if this were an ordinary story, it would end right there. But this story of the universe keeps unfolding. What once began in a blazing blossom of light continues every day. New stars sprout open in the deep soil of space. New plants and animals appear on the earth. Seeds of many kinds are scattered everywhere to help us remember. And new people are born every day with the spark of that first light still alive and burning deep inside, waiting like the everything seed to shine in ways that are yet to be known. You are going to grow and do wonderful things, things that we can't even imagine now. And the grown-up program today is about this whole universe, from the very tiny to the very, very large. So let's have you go to your classes, and we'll start the grown-up program. Learn and love.
This is a poem by Jim Harrison entitled Small Gods. My hope is that this minuscule prayer will reach out to the God unknown I just sensed, passing in the rivulet of breeze above the mere rivulet of water in this small arroyo. To the skittering insect, this place is as large as the Sea of Galilee. In prayer, I'm a complicated insect, moving this way and that. The insect before me puzzles over its current god, my dog Zilpha, who watches with furrowed brow and thinks, should I paw at this bug in this shallow pool, bite it, roll on it in this tiny creek in the late afternoon heat, or perhaps take another nap? She looks at her god, which is me, understanding as her eyes close that the gods make up their minds as they go. They are as patient as the water in which they live, and won't be surprised when they reach the sea with their vast collection of reflections, the man, the dog, the stars and moon and clouds, the javelina and countless birds, bugs and minnows, the delicate sips of rattlers, the boughs of mesquite, the carapace of the desert tortoise, the heron footprints, the water's memories of earth. Please rise and join us in hymn number 339, Knowledge, They Say.
Well, we have a big topic to cover in a small amount of time, so let's get started. And everything we discuss today will be in reference to a meter. And just so happens, I have a meter. It's just hard to get in the United States, by the way. But this is a meter stick. And so I'm just a bit under 2 meters tall. Also, a frame of reference, an American football field, including the end zones, is about 110 meters. And there, of course, are 1,000 of these in a kilometer. Okay, so with that, here's a primer on what we're going to be talking about today.
So let's have that first video, and can we hit the lights so that... Now, the video describes things of all sizes, from small to large. But the first minute of this video, I should say, is pretty speculative. We don't know the natural laws that govern things that small, nor even if the idea of that size, that small, is meaningful. Now, about here, we're getting to the stage that we do know the natural laws, and for the next minute or so, the things that they talk about are things that we do understand. We know about atoms, that was nuclei, know about nuclei. We know about electrons. And soon we'll get to atoms that are 10,000 times bigger than the nucleus. You have cosmic rays. Now here we have atoms. Atoms will come back. They're my favorite, Steve. Carbon atom, water molecule, cesium atoms. And now we get to the complicated stuff, where biology comes into play with the cell walls up there in the upper corner and DNA. Then bacteria. Ultraviolet light is about a wavelength this size. Bacteria will come to again. White blood cells, mucus, fiber. We're getting to the size of a human hair. The smallest thing that you could likely see, better eyes than mine, would be about this size. An amoeba, for example, the largest bacteria. And now we get up to daily experience. Ants, pencils, coffee. And we understand the laws of nature at this scale. We understand elephants and airplanes. Phenomena that we do understand. Although, I should caution, it's complicated. There's lots of work left for biologists and ecologists, for chemists and geologists to do. Now we're getting up to the size of geological formation. And once we start hitting Everest and the Marianas Trench, we're dealing with some of the biggest things on the surface of the Earth. Of course, all of this is dwarfed by what goes on inside, and there's lots still to understand about the interior of the Earth. There we have planets. By the way, Neptune having a ring too, something that we didn't know when I was a child. And on out to the stars. At this scale, we still know the laws and can figure out how things behave, and in fact, use our knowledge of how stars behave, how stars live and die, to produce those elements that we talked about in the children's story. Now we're getting to the distance that the farthest human-made object has traveled. We'll talk later about just how big a light year is. Pillars of creation, the Eagle Nebula is a famous picture of stars being born, again, as mentioned in that story for all ages. And then we come to the bigger scale, the scale of galaxies, our galaxy and its neighbors, the Magellanic Clouds, the Andromeda Galaxy, our brother galaxy, and our local group of galaxies. About couple of dozen galaxies in this local group, and out beyond that are the other clusters of galaxies. And at this stage, we still can understand what's happening. We can see the galaxies and the distances behaving. We're going to see a picture of that deep field later. And this last moment gets us to a scale in which the mystery comes back. We know we don't know what the laws are for the very, very largest
the universe on the very, very largest scale. This is where dark energy comes in that you may have seen in the headline. And so, from the large, back now, down to the very small, that's what the program's about this morning. Now, let's talk, let's hit the lights just a moment here. First, let's look at a small scale. My favorite small scale is the scale of atoms. And the reason that I really like atoms is that on the one hand, we have to use the most fundamental theory, physical theory we have, quantum mechanics, to understand them. And yet, atoms are what determine the way things happen in our daily life. It's atoms that make my ring shiny and conduct heat and electricity. And it's atoms that make the sky blue and the clouds white. Let's see, there's a picture of an atom here. If we can focus that a little better, that would be good. But if we can't, then... Pardon? That's it. Okay. All right. The little dots that you see are atoms. And engineers at IBM manipulated the atoms to make a rather abstract version of the Starship Enterprise over there. And you can see that atoms are smaller than 1 nanometer. Atoms are typically on the order of a 20th to a tenth or so, a few tenths of a nanometer. And so that's one small scale. And I remind you that that scale, the scale of an atom, is 10,000 times bigger than the scale of a nucleus, which, again, we understand quite well, thank you, as both nuclear power plants in Hiroshima and Nagasaki attest. But let's now move up in scale. We'll go up, we'll talk about bacteria. Bacteria are 10,000 to 100,000 times bigger than those atoms that we're looking at there. So, and we've got a video. Now, we could talk about atoms on our skin, not atoms, bacteria, excuse me, on our skin, bacteria in our gut, but it's a little more interesting to look at some bacteria that occur deep down in the ocean. You're looking at these are this is a video taken way underwater as the camera drops down closer and closer to what are called thermal vents or black smokers. These are places that the Earth's crust is pulling apart, letting hot water out. And these are little marine creatures that are living near these vents that are in water that's close to the boiling point. We're picking this picture, this situation, because it will expand our knowledge or expand our view of what is needful for life. We might have thought that that living in boiling water was not in the cards. Well, living in almost boiling water is in the cards for these creatures, which are, of course, are much, much, much bigger than bacteria. But I think we're about to get a picture of a bacterium. Well, maybe not. Let's just enjoy the black smoker a little bit more and use that as another little mind expander. The Earth that seems so stable, of course, is composed, the crust is composed of huge plates that move slowly, to be sure. But that motion not only produces these vents, but also the earthquakes, volcanoes, the ring of fire, and so on. So let's see. There's a slide next. Ah, there it is. Yeah. By the way, when I was talking about atoms, I should have given you an idea about just how big they are. If you think about your fingernail, just imagine a line drawn across your fingernail. 100 million, there are, because your fingernail's made of atoms, there are about 100 million atoms, 100 million atoms spread across that that fingernail. That's how small an atom is. Now, this bacterium is a giant among bacteria. This bacterium is about the size of your fingernail, okay? Most bacteria are 1,000 times smaller than that, or 10,000 times smaller than that even. But I want to call your attention to this picture. To keep it in mind, because we're going to relate it to a picture later. Notice the blue stuff is outside the cell. The red stuff is inside the cell. And that little yellowish-green thing is the cell wall. Notice how, just notice its size in comparison to the whole cell. The size of that wall that protects the cell in comparison to the whole cell. And so bacteria are everywhere. And the these black smokers are not necessarily the most difficult or environment to live in. They're bacteria that live in nuclear waste. They're bacteria that live in sulfuric acid. And furthermore, bacteria can go into a kind of extended hibernation. There was an NPR story about bacteria that had been anthrax bacteria, by the way, nasty stuff, that had been isolated in a reindeer carcass that was for 2,000 years had been frozen. But it's thawed out now, and the anthrax is now able to do its work in lots of other reindeer. And so we've gone from the atom, 100 millionth the size of your fingernail, to bacteria, typically about 10,000 times bigger than that, all the way to this giant that is, again, the size of your fingernail. But now, Mark has some other stuff about bacteria.
Well, surely something as small and insignificant as what we're looking at, of course, obviously that's blown up quite a bit, it isn't all that important, but probably everybody knows that we're full of bacteria. There's trillions and trillions of bacteria cells within us. If you look at your just on the surface of your skin, I bet there's about 100,000 bacteria cells per square centimeter. So there's lots of them. So it's kind of a big deal. They're very small, but they're kind of a big deal. And one of the other things that they do, of course, is they supply a greater part of our of Earth's oxygen as well. So we've found these extremophiles around the black smokers in the radioactive waste. So doesn't that tell us something about where else life may exist in our universe? It exists in, on, and around our Earth. But could I get you to turn on at least the outer? Yeah, that's fine. Thank you. So something we need to consider is, are we really so special? Is the Earth so unique that it's the only place in the universe blessed with life? Armed with the knowledge of the adaptability of bacteria and its ability to hibernate almost indefinitely, isn't it probable that life, at least on some level, exists in many places in our universe? Scientists have been surveying the heavens for the past few years, a dozen plus years, looking for planets that are orbiting their respective suns at a certain distance, something we call the habitable zone or the Goldilocks zone, right? Goldilocks is not too hot, not too cold, not too far, not too close, and have been finding hundreds of such planets in distant solar systems. These planets should be able to support the existence of liquid water. Therefore, they should be able to support life forms similar to what we find on Earth. But let's come back to the knowledge of just how adaptable bacteria are. Their existence does not rely on such a sweet spot in space. Indeed, it may be a rule rather than an exception that life of some sort exists in the universe. Now, that's merely a conjecture on my part, of course. In 1961, an astronomer by the name of Frank Drake offered an equation, not for the purposes of exactly quantifying the number of civilizations that may exist in our Milky Way galaxy, but as a way to stimulate scientific dialogue at a meeting of the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, or SETI. While it has its detractors, I think it does exactly what it intends. It gets the dialogue going. And we're going to watch a video of an explanation of Drake's equation now.
What is a more shocking idea? That thousands of alien civilizations are humming away in our galaxy right now, or that we are all that there is? Now, consider the numbers involved. We live in a universe with billions upon billions of stars. Our Milky Way galaxy has, at the lowest estimate, 100 billion stars or suns, and at the highest estimate, 400 billion suns. The Milky Way is only one of millions of galaxies out there in the vast cold void of space. So even if the probability of intelligent life emerging is exceedingly small, the sheer number of stars in the heavens would suggest that we really are not alone. One man who tried to solve this astronomical conundrum was Frank Drake. He listed all of the questions that scientists would need to answer in order to predict the number of detectable civilizations in the galaxy. He then realized that if all of the questions were multiplied together, you would then have the estimate for the number of detectable civilizations. And so the Drake equation was born. So Rx refers to the yearly rate of star formation in our galaxy. The next term in the equation is FP, or the fraction of stars that actually have planetary systems. So now that we've got planets, okay, how many of those planets are actually habitable? There's still a lot we don't know about extrasolar planets, so it's difficult to put an exact figure on NE. You can have potential for life, but how many actually do support life? This is represented by FL in the Drake equation. FI, the number of habitable planets where intelligence actually arises. Drake was interested in using radio astronomy to seek out extraterrestrial civilizations. So his original formulation of the equation factored in the likelihood that they would communicate in ways that we could detect. Represented by FC. Back in the 1960s, it was widely believed that radio would be the communications technology of choice for an advanced civilization. In fact, our own planet has been telegraphing evidence of our technological civilization for nearly 80 years. There are hundreds of stars within 80 light years of Earth that could conceivably harbor life. But would other intelligent civilizations even use radio? Perhaps it's too passé for them, like smoke signals are to us. There's also the possibility that an alien civilization would deliberately mask its presence from its neighbors. You can make a case that some civilizations may be hostile. Therefore, betraying your existence to them may not be too smart. The final term in the Drake equation is a little bit depressing. What's the average length of time a technological civilization stays detectable? Drake himself was worried that an advanced civilization might not be detectable for very long. It's possible that many civilizations are easily detectable for only a short period of time, even though they continue to thrive for thousands and thousands and millions of years. So what's the answer? According to Drake's original calculations in 1961, n equaled somewhere between 4 and 10. However, revising many of Drake's estimates with the latest scientific knowledge, we get a different result. We arrive with a new figure for n of a very low 0.00127. It means that during any 100,000-year period in our galaxy's history, around 127 detectable civilizations will crop up. Drake himself maintains an air of optimism. He has a strong conviction that extraterrestrial civilizations exist in our galaxy today. He estimates that there are about 10,000 of them in the Milky Way right now, which sounds like a lot, right? But even if all of them were detectable, it would still take a long time to find even one. If our galaxy has a minimum of 100 billion stars, then you need to search 10 million stars before you start to worry that they ain't so common.
So Drake's equation deals with, concerns itself with intelligent species, ones that we can detect, again, through radio waves or maybe something different in the future. Does not talk about simple life like bacteria, single-cell organisms, or anything like that. One recent criticism argues about Drake's equation that just using the existence of evidence of our own existence doesn't necessarily mean that there's any other life out there. We may be unique. But I think that's just a simple dismissive stance that attempts to use a false logic to minimize the possibility of life elsewhere. I hope it's obvious that none of the factors within Drake's equation are absolutely known. And they're big, huge, wild guesses. Therefore, the number of civilizations cannot be absolutely known. But it sure is fun to talk about, I think, anyway. So let's talk about something a bit bigger than bacteria. We've established a few facts. Some about 2 meters tall. There's 110 meters in a football field. And let's keep going. The city of Manhattan, measuring east to west, is about 9,670 meters. Again, just to remind you, this is a meter. So, Riley County, measured north to south, is about 56,341 meters tall. Kansas, 661,000 meters wide. And the Earth is 12,742,000 meters in diameter. So let's talk about Earth. Go ahead, next slide. Here you go.
Remember that bacterium that's the size of your fingernail and what its skin looked like? Well, that narrow little tiny bit of blue is our atmosphere, the atmosphere that we require, the atmosphere that we are changing. And when we think about that, it often provokes a kind of depression. Damn, we're putting the methane and the CO2 in the atmosphere that's going to change things, warm the Earth. But I'd like to call your attention to the fact that there are grounds for optimism. 20-30 years ago, we were rightly concerned with the use of chlorofluorocarbons in air conditioning systems, because those molecules attacked the ozone, which plays a very important role in keeping the water-laden part of our atmosphere, we call the troposphere, down close to Earth and not running on up away. The ozone is important for what's called the stratospheric inversion layer. In any case, we stopped. The whole world, all the countries, stopped producing CFCs and stopped using them. And today, the ozone is not falling apart further. And so I throw this one in just to expand our
view of the possibility that our human civilization can make good choices. And now Mark has further stuff. Oh, before he does, though, let me ask you to keep in mind the scale of the Earth. You know, when we look out over the Kansas River Valley, we're only looking a short distance, maybe 1 kilometer or 2 kilometers. There are 12,000 kilometers in the size of the Earth. So try to keep in mind some idea of just how big this Earth is, because we're going to need that in subsequent developments.
So back in the day, around the 2nd century, actually, a guy named Claudius Ptolemaeus laid the groundwork for what we consider modern astronomy today. And he did a lot of good work. He named the stars. He listed their brightnesses. He believed that the Earth was a sphere, because there were some people that, well, I guess today still don't think that it is. And he did other things. But he missed it a bit when he argued that the Earth was at the center of the universe. This is called the geocentric model of the universe. This notion held sway until 1543, when Nicholas Copernicus proposed that the sun, and not the Earth, was at the center of the universe. As you can imagine, this caused a bit of an uproar, with the Catholic Church banning all of his books, and they called him some seriously bad names. This is called the heliocentric model of the universe, which is closer. Further work, mostly by a German Protestant by the name of Johannes Kepler, along with help from his self-exiled Danish nobleman, Tycho Brahe, and his extensive observations, established the rules of the motions of the planets on the heliocentric model. It was Isaac Newton who was able to put sense to motions of the planets and seek a harmony in the heavens in the latter half of the 17th century. Newton was able to grasp that the forces involved with the motions of the planets, even over such large distances, surely must also rule the motions of the objects besides the planets. And this has become a fairly famous picture. When we get too full of ourselves, I think it's a good idea to step back and look at this from the perspective of Saturn, and that little tiny little dot there at the top of that line is the Earth and the Moon.
Tiny, may not even be able to see it.
Right. It's that tiny.
That little dot at the top of the line, that's the Earth. As seen from Saturn.
The Earth's solar system, consisting of our sun and 8 or 9, depending on your spin, or more planets, resides in the Milky Way galaxy. So that's what we're going to next. We're going to look at these bigger and bigger things. For this, we have to start talking about space, outer space. And I thought it would be appropriate to quote Douglas Adams. Douglas Adams says, "Space is big. You just won't believe how vastly, hugely, mind-bogglingly big it is. I mean, you may think it's a long way down the road to the chemists, but that's just peanuts to space."
Okay. When we start talking about the stars and our galaxy, especially when, let's focus on galaxies here just a minute. Well, even stars. The distances to the stars, we have to talk about not in terms of meters, because we'd just be trailing zeros and zeros and zeros. Instead, we talk about it in terms of a light year. Now, remember how big the Earth is, okay? All right, keep that thought in mind. Next, think about how much experience you can pack into 1 second. So now let's just do it right now. I'm going to go 1,000, okay? Now think about how much life you lived there. 1,000. Now compare that much experience to a lifetime. Okay? 30, 70, 100 years. That is how big one light year is in comparison to the Earth. Okay? Try again. 1 second is to a lifetime, as the Earth is to one light year. Okay? How far away are the stars? Well, the ones that we see at night are 10 to a few thousand light years away. And these stars that we see at night are part of our galaxy, the Milky Way, which is about 100,000 light years across. And we, if this is the middle, we're about out here in a big spiral arm of stars. And in this galaxy, 100,000 light years across. Oh, by the way, you might wonder how closely packed are the stars? Well, the stars are a few light years apart. And how big is a star? Well, our sun is a fairly typical star and is a few light seconds across. So again, how empty is our galaxy? A few seconds is the size. A few years is the distance between the stars, okay? And so our galaxy is, and other galaxies, in these galaxies, the stars are not closely packed. Galaxies can collide and pass through one another with the stars barely noticing it, okay? I was remind myself of what happens next. Oh, yeah. What happens next is that now that I've mentioned that our universe consists of galaxies or clusters of galaxies, a couple of dozen galaxies in our local group of our local cluster called the local group, total of maybe 100 billion galaxies. Mark is going to have a few things to say about that.
So we know now how big the Milky Way galaxy is. That's pretty well determined. But it's relatively new knowledge. In the 17th century, they really had no idea how far stars were from Earth. One approach taken was to attempt to compare the brightness of a star with the relative brightness of a small part of the sun, of our sun. So they would punch a series of holes of varying sizes into a brass plate. They'd go out at night and they'd find a star. Let's just use Sirius, for example, a pretty bright star. And they would hold that up until they found the hole that would fit the entirety of Sirius in it. And then they would have to remember how bright that was. And then the next day they would go outside and they would use that same disc and look actually through a small lens at the sun. And if they thought that the size of that hole was about the intensity of light coming through that size of that hole was the same, then they did some math, fairly simple math, and they determined that the star was X light years away, X distance. The problem is that you had to remember how bright something was the night before. And they also didn't know that the things, they thought that if it was dimmer, it was just further away. But of course, now we understand the fact that things that are dimmer and just may be close, but dimmer. And so there's very varying light intensity. They've figured that out, obviously, till now. Or now they have. Well into the 20th century, astronomers believed that there was only one galaxy, ours. And all of the clouds, the spiral clouds and the spiral nebula viewed through telescopes were just condensing clouds of interstellar gas on their way to becoming other solar systems. To test the distance to these clouds, astronomers used a class of intrinsically brighter variable stars called Cepheid variables to establish a new standard candle. So these are special stars. They know exactly how bright they are. And so they can tell if it's dim, it's far away. And in fact, what they found, what they discovered, is that these Cepheid variables were indeed very dim, and so they were indeed very far away. So these couldn't be just condensing clouds in our local area. They actually had to be additional galaxies out there in space. And today we estimate that there are 100 to 200 billion galaxies in our universe. So this is, if you can see, I picked it out because, yeah, we do the lights there. So this, when you walk out in Kansas, this is normally what you see, right? I mean, the sky and a windmill, right? And I think I picked the, just making sure. Anyway, the idea here is that let's do a little activity. This is going to wrap up our journey today. So you can go ahead and turn lights back on. Thanks. If you'd hold your little pinky, your little finger out, and hold it out at arm's length, imagine we're outside and we're blocking part of the sky out with our pinky. Now take 1/30th of that, of the size, right? That's about one arc second. Is that right? Yeah. You take 1/30th of that, so a very, very, very small sliver of that. I don't think anybody has that small of a finger, but 1/30th of that. Now let's look at this picture. So our last picture. Okay. So what this picture is actually taking 1/30th of the width of your pinky by about the same square. And astronomers took these pictures using two million seconds, 23 days over a 10-year span. Remember how tiny this little patch of sky is. And what this represents is there's about 5,500 galaxies in this picture. We can't see them all, but every dot of light from the brightest that you see around to the most dim that you could pick out if you were looking at it very close, those are all galaxies.
That cannot be emphasized enough.
Yeah.
Every little dot you see is a 100 billion stars. Okay. The tiniest little dot out there. It's tiny because it's far away. Looking there at close to the beginning, the earliest thing in the universe.
Yeah, in fact, they think that the farthest distance, one of these that they're looking at, is about 13.2 billion years. Or light years away, which means that you're seeing the light from 13.2 billion years ago, which is only about 5% of the age of the universe. So it happened a long time ago if you're looking that far back in time. So that's mind-bogglingly big indeed, in my opinion. And that's it. If you rise, you are able, and join us in singing hymn 310, Touch the Sky, 301, transcribed everything, Touch the Earth, Reach the Sky.
301.
Yeah, 301.
this universe, our universe, is awe-inspiringly large. This universe, our universe, is awe-inspiringly wonderful. May we be inspired to live wonderful lives by thinking about our home. So be it.